was completely destroyed by the Experiencer Air. The cool guys were in commercial radio back in the early 80s, you see. Oh, yeah. After 30 years, you would have thought somebody would say, thanks very much indeed.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Alex Lester.
Young Alex, growing up, had absolutely no interest in the radio whatsoever. I was a sort of a spotty schoolboy doing all those things that spotty schoolboys do, and not really being a very academic creature either, much to the disappointment of my father, who was in fact a GP, so therefore he had brains aplenty, and he discovered he had an idiot son who was far more interested in staring out of the window. It was one of those school reports always show that he did the bare minimum to get by, which has really in some ways been the watchword, really, you know, and so therefore I could only do things that I liked. As far as academic subjects at school, I liked English and history because I was interested in those, but I couldn't add up to save my life and don't even mention science. As far as that growing up point of view, I had a fabulous time. I had a sister and, you know, sister and me dad and me mum, and we went on nice holidays. Though it did rain, it snowed in Wales one June, and after that my mother put a foot down and we went to Mallorca the following year, which was great, and we all got food poisoning. But it was a tremendous experience, you know, when you think of it back in the late 60s, early 70s, of all these people going to Spain for the first time, because of course it was this whole thing about the beginning of the package tour. Try imagining this now, and they've all been to the ball fight, and they all come back, and they've all got swords, and they've all got those sticky things they used to stick in the hapless bull's back, etc. And everybody is tooled up. They've got daggers and everything like that, and they all get on the aeroplane and they stow them in the overhead locker. Bit of turbulence and a few swords to fall into the aisle. That's not going to happen now, is it, when you think about it? But that was my upbringing. As far as the radio was concerned, I did what usual kids did. I listened to Radio Luxembourg under the covers with my, my sister had a Shearer Fox, that was hers, and I had a Pi radio, which I was given when I was 14, I seem to remember.
Don't let me down, could be the number one next week. And I'll tell you what, we'll play the flip side. Called Get Back with, of course, Paul McCartney on lead. And here it is, Get Back. Both sides of the Beatles tonight on the program. 2-8 down server.
My mother used to listen to Housewives' Choice, so I can still remember the theme tune to that. And also she'd listen to Woman's Hour, and that I do remember made an enormous impression on me, basically because you realise that all human life was out there, because I remember the letters section, and they'd been talking obviously about nudity, and someone had written in and saying, I've refused to show my body to anybody. I wear a leotard when I'm in the bath. My husband has never seen me naked. And fairly shortly, I have to go into hospital for an intimate operation. I'm going to insist that the surgeon wears a blindfold. And you're thinking, this is marvellous. You know, he couldn't have made it up. I mean, maybe it was a spoof and I don't know, but it seemed very real to me at the time.
I think this next item is going to make some of you very angry. But these two young people have chosen deliberately to cohabit rather than marry. If their attitudes shock you or even just irritate you, as they well may, it's perhaps worth remembering that today there are other young people, particularly in the big cities, who hold this...
So as far as actually getting into the radio, no idea. Because radio was where, you know, people were on it. By the time I was a cool teen, you know, I was listening to John Peel and I was listening to Alan Black and Annie Nightingale and Bob Harris, etc.
Good evening and welcome to the Led Zeppelin Show. The purpose of the programme tonight is to provide a platform which allows bands removed from the normal confines of the record industry and free from commercial manipulation to present a true statement about their music.
Because they had prog rock and all that sort of stuff on, you know, that's who I was listening to. And so poor old Tony Blackburn wouldn't have got a look in because he was... pop music, nonsense. I was into progressive rock. What a mistake that was. You know, I'll never get those hours back listening to my Greenslade albums. But still, it was of its time. But I never thought I'd be on the radio. So having left school with, you know, really rather a grim selection of exams, of two A-levels and about five or six, like John Major, I can't remember how many O-levels I've got, but it wasn't very many, with no idea what to do at all. Wandered around thinking about it, and my father sort of sent me to the Vocational Guidance Association in Upper Harley Street. And my mother made me wear my suit to go to going up to town, because it was in Walsall, for goodness sake. Went to London, and in about an hour, they wanted you to fill in these forms by poking the answers of multiple choice with a skewer. And there were multiple choice, and you had to do so many And the idea was this would get to the deep and dark recesses of your mind, and so you'd know exactly what it was that what made you tick. And there were questions like, what would you rather be, a dustman dead or the conductor of the Halley Orchestra? All I remember was I got a blister on my index finger from stabbing away at these forms, bits of card they were. And at the end of it, they said, oh, you want to do something with people. And I thought, do I? How about public relations? Don't even know what that is. So, you know, I went down the library and looked at public relations and started writing to various people. There was still industry left in the UK at that point, so you had things like British Steel, which had its own PR department, the National Coal Board, I wrote to all them, and also I wrote to public relations agencies, because of which there are a few. And I remember going to Manders Public Relations Agency in Hales Owen. And then I went in to see this bloke who did the same thing. As I was leaving, there was this chap. I think he was the reincarnation of Bob Cratchit. And he said, I couldn't help overhearing the conversation you had with my boss. What you need to do to get experience is go and do a communication studies diploma at Birmingham Polytechnic, which is what I did. And look at me now. You know, okay, all right, so there's a look of success. So that's exactly what I did. I was due to go, and a friend of mine phoned up and said, you fancy going off to France for 3 weeks? I went, yeah. Talk about ultimate short-termism. I did tell my mother this before she died, I'm delighted to say, but it was a long time. And so therefore I went home and said, oh, course is full this year, I'll have to go next year. So off I went to France for 3 weeks, and I thought, what the bloody hell am I going to do now? So I had to get a job, which meant that I was a filing clerk at the DHSS. They made me redundant, ironically, and I became a clerical officer at the Employment Exchange until they busted me down to clerical assistant. And then I did manage to get into this course for the next year. And it had a module, if you like, in the summer, the second half of the summer term of the first 2 years, you would go off and do work experience. So the first year, Beacon Radio in Wolverhampton was opening. So I thought, oh, right, OK, this is marvellous. So they're like, can I go there? They said, yeah, of course you can. Music is the sunshine. Beacon 303. I turned up to have a look round, you know, a few weeks beforehand. And the first person I met upon sort of knocking on the door down in Tettenhall Road was George Ferguson. And he looked at me, this sort of pimply Herbert, and he went, fucking how do? I thought, I like this man. And then about 2 days before I was due to go, they said, oh, sorry, it's such chaos here trying to open a new radio station. If anybody's ever tried to open a radio station, you know that is what is the definition of chaos? It is trying to open a radio station on time. I don't know whether I even got much beyond to start off with, into the hallway. And the second year, they went, all right, where do you want to go? I thought, well, I better have another crack at radio, because I was at Lucas's, the car component people, writing for their in-house magazine, Reflections. If you want to know anything about the Rover 2000 headlamp, I can tell you. And the second year, I went to Pebble Mill. I went to Radio Birmingham, the heart of the nation station. And I opened the door to the production office, and there were two people standing toe-to-toe, nose-to-nose, yelling at each other at the top of their voices. There was purple-faced people, veins twitching on their forehead, sweat. And I thought, wow, this is really interesting.
Good morning, everybody. This is BBC Radio Birmingham, your local radio station for Birmingham, Coventry, Wolverhampton and the Black Country, broadcasting on 95.6 VHF.
So I got cups of coffee, I helped out, and what I did was Dymo-taped my parents' landline number, because it was way before the days of mobile phones, the phone number to the typewriters in the office, which said, Alex Lester, exploit me, and my parents' phone number. And the next day they phoned. So for the whole of the final year I was at college in Birmingham, I was the gopher on the breakfast show, the Heart of the Nation programme, on the Heart of the Nation station, Radio Birmingham, and started to do the odd reporting shift. We're talking 1977, so this is now 40 years ago, and started to help out. And then eventually ended up doing evening continuity shifts, because Radio Birmingham had been going 7 years by that point, but it was still local radio, still modelled on the old sort of Home the Light and the Third in many ways, and it had all sorts of bizarre yet wonderful and community based programmes.
First, your local headlines. Worley's chief dental officer is definitely going to stand for election to Birmingham City Council.
There was Locks, Pounds and Paddles, which was the canal aficionados programme. There was a programme for numismatists called It's More Than Money. There was a bloke called Norman who did the angling programme. And there was another chap called Norman who did the folk programme, Folk Weave. And there was a wonderful Ken Dewdney who did the country programme. And Heavy Pressure with Malcolm J for rock enthusiasts. There was something for everybody there. And, of course, there was a whole slew of programmes for ethnic minorities, like, Barry Curtis used to do a fantastic reggae and gospel show. And that's where I learned the immortal phrase, putting some dip in your hip and some glide in your stride, from the excellent Barry Curtis. Thank you for that, Barry. And there was the various Asian programmes as well, which were, again, fascinating. Very often they were in Urdu or Gujarati or whatever. I had no idea what was going on. But, you know, I would wait for the person to wave at me and then I'd wow the record in. Couldn't really tell a lot of them with a lot of the records because, of course, it was music that was totally new to me. But it was a fabulous experience. And the thing about it was at Pebble Mill. So therefore, we used to nick all our celebrity guests for Home James, the afternoon show, from Pebble Mill at One.
I saw a picture of you in one of the national papers the day after you arrived, and you had this whacking great ladder in your stocking, and I hate to tell you this, but I think you've done it again.
I have it again.
The number of times I must have dragged poor old Peter Skellen off the shop floor, if you like, that you come in with us. But it was great, and it had its own bar. What joy was this for a 19-year-old? Fantastic. You not only got to go and stand in the same place as Tom Coyne from Midlands Today, and my mother go, I saw Kay Alexander up close. She looks very nice, you know.
I'm down here to meet Bill Pearson, who's got a very unusual hobby, and I think we'll go meet him now.
It was fascinating, and you'd see all these people. And I can remember standing on the back of Anger and Reese's frock on one occasion in the BBC club because they were doing the interiors at Pebble Mill for the, to my mind, the original Poldark. And they paid you, and there was beer. If you don't want that as a career, I don't know what is anybody would want, frankly, and so therefore I was hooked. I thought I could probably be a producer eventually. I never imagined myself on it. But being in the building, you had access to the notice board with the jobs on. Now, the job at that time, to start off with, was a thing called a station assistant, which meant you helped out, you did reporting stuff, you did whatever was necessary, really. It was the sort of just above gopher. And so I applied for 13 of these around the country, a couple at Radio Leicester. I went to Radio Carlisle, as it was, drove all the way up there, made a fool of myself and drove all the way back down again. I went to London because they actually had one going on Radio Highland in Inverness, which was really rather embarrassing because I went to London for the preliminary interview, not the full interview, and I turned up and there were two people behind the desk. There was a woman who was impossibly glamorous, whose name was Moira de Burka, I can remember that, and a chap who had a kilt on. They asked me about Radio Highland in Inverness. I'm actually going red thinking about this, the worst interview you can ever imagine. So, can you speak the language? Oh, Gaelic. Oh, we prefer to call it Gaelic ourselves up there. No, but I'm willing to learn. I can still remember this. It's engraved on my heart. Have you been to Inverness? No, but I hear it's lovely. And it went downhill from there. And then, at the end of it, the chap, I don't know what his name was, I apologise all these years later for wasting your time, produced a cash box from beneath the desk and went, you've come from Birmingham. I mean, that's a second-class return, so-and-so, so-and-so, and handed me the cash there, so I got on the train and went back. But eventually I got the 12th out of the 13th job, which was as a locum. I travelled around the country filling in on BBC local stations in England, and it was great because there was me, there was Rob Bonnet, who's now a big cheese on the television in sport and radio and sport, Mark Hurrell, who ended up being the manager of editor of Gloucestershire. Gary Richardson was on it, which was the Today programme sports guy. I think I replaced him because he left. I was based in Birmingham, so if there was no other work around the BBC local radio system, I'd go back to Birmingham. And the first day they said, you are going to Radio Humberside in Hull. And no word of a lie, I had to get the Atlas out to find out where Hull was. And then I drove all the way up there and parked at Hull Paragon Station. You could smell the fish being landed. This was about 78. And turned up at the station, absolutely terrified.
I believe that this local radio will prosper only insofar as it attracts the interest and the participation of the communities it is designed to serve.
It was just wonderful. Within 2 days, I was presenting the farming programme, not that I knew anything about farming at all. It was a station, you realised then how ingrained in an area a successful station could be. Because, despite the fact it had some of the most bizarre programming by today's standards, it was number one in the market. Radio 1, forget it. Radio Humberside was the boss station in town. It started with a pretty nearly all-speech breakfast show called Morning Tide. And then they had, I think, Both Sides Now. There was a phone-in with a chap called Robin Pulford, who was just like a god around the town and the city, whatever. And they had educational programmes, which were really fascinating, really, really interesting. Lots of farming, as I say, sport, because it was rugby league. And then they had the odd, so you had some very unusual sort of programmes which would appear sort of around about lunchtime. One of my favourites was Call Clivy, which was a bloke called Clive Hunter, who was an organist in one of the local clubs, because working men's clubs were still huge back then. And we had to put a submixer on the desk because there weren't enough channels. And the trouble is, you see, he had his organ, which was there in the studio, and the mics went for miking up the organ, you see. And so therefore we actually had, I think, only one fader for the organ and his voice mic. He didn't sing because the others were used for phones. And bearing in mind, of course, you know, the people who would phone up probably were born in the tail end of the 19th century, because we're talking, you know, late 70s, and they were in their 80s at this particular point. Also, I think that he didn't necessarily know lots of different tunes, but because he was a club organist, he could make a fair fist of everything. And it was wonderful old stuff. So if someone goes, "Hello, Clive." You know, "Hello, love, what do you want?" "I'd like Silver Threads Amongst the Gold, please." "I tell you what, how about Palomy Cradle Days?" "Okay, that'll do." And so therefore, then he'd start playing, and on the end of the phone, this little old lady went, "Yeah, Palomy Cradle." And all you could hear about this was this sound of emphysema, because his mic was still up. going on, which was marvellous. And of course, it would have you weeping with mirth. But they loved it. He couldn't get enough. Whether that would work now is a moot point. Radio Humberside, BBC. Other places I went, at Radio Cleveland. I read the news at Radio Cleveland because that was the job. And they had a programme there called Dad's Music, which was 78 and stuff like that. Again, I think that was probably pretty popular. I spent one day at Radio Leeds. That was because they had the Leeds Feast, which is their big brass band competition. And so I was there to sort of lug cables around for that. I went to a lot of the stations where actually I'd applied for jobs and didn't get them, which is quite ironic, really, but they'd forgotten, luckily.
This is BBC Radio Leicester.
My first ever radio show, purely by accident, on Radio Leicester, ironically, when the late, great Mike Dickin was doing the breakfast show. And that was all kind of horror in many ways, not because of the people there. It's just that it was on the 8th and 9th floor of Epic House in Leicester, and they had no air conditioning. And it was a Mark 1 station. If you were an anorak, you'll know it had the little rotary faders, and it had a tiny little desk. It wasn't the terribly sophisticated Mark 2 desk, which came in 1970. Oh, no, this was the original 1967 one. And Mike Dickin smoked cigars. Then there was the request show, followed by Crosstalk with Morgan Cross, who smoked cigarettes, one after another for 2 or 3 hours or whatever. So therefore, the whole of the studio was just brown. It was the most disgusting environment to be in. But one bank holiday, I was the operator, because, you know, it wasn't totally sophisticated. We had outside sources and things like that, which you couldn't really get up if you were the presenter. And at 9 o'clock that day, there was no local journalism at that point. Now, of course, everyone was on holiday. We went to Radio 4 for the news at 9 o'clock. And totally out of the blue, Mike Dickin goes, "Well, that's all from me. I'm off to Mallory Park to drive a rally car. Alex Lester's after the news. Bye." And I went, "What?" He went, "Yeah, that's it." And he came out of the studio and he says, "I played those," pointed to one pile of records, "and I haven't played those. Have fun." Slam. And disappeared in a wave of, you know, in a gust of cigar smoke. And so therefore, at 9:05, when the Radio 4 news finished, I closed the fader and lurched into my first ever radio show playing, I remember, Jolene.
Jolene, 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 Jolene.
And I was there for about an hour and a quarter, then we joined network for the rest of the day or whatever, and when I came into work, that was like, it was a Saturday or something like that, when I came back into work on the Monday, thinking, "Oh, enjoyed the show, Alex, did you like doing it?" Thinking, actually, yeah, I did. You know, when I stopped shaking, Yeah, I really like that. And then I got sent to Radio Carlisle as well, where I did drive time. Again, this was 1977, 78, no, 88, 78, 79, which was 5:15 until 7 minutes to six, with one needle time record and not the all-important gardening feature with Henry Noblet in the Whitehaven studio. And I was there for about a month, and I got to do this nearly every day. The grams are on your left-hand side as you were facing the desk, which, anoraks, was in fact the first ever prototype Mark III desk, BBC Mark III. It wasn't the Mark III that ended up places like Radio London or whatever, but it was the prototype, so it looked pretty similar, but wasn't quite there yet. And grams are on the left-hand side. I actually had to hold my right hand, which had the pickup arm, with my left in order to put it on the record because it was shaking so much. And I remember the programme organiser, because that's what they had in those days, coming into the studio and saying, "Is that very relaxed for a man who's shaking so much?" and disappear. And after a couple of 3 weeks, I thought, this is what I want to do with my life now. I want to be on the radio. At that point, the itch had, you know, it had got under my skin. That's right, the monster ego probably started to loom inside me. Ah, yes, this is what I want to do. I want to be the man on the radio. And that's pretty much what I've been ever since, really. The man on the radio. And I've had a thoroughly marvellous time, really. Well, after going and doing, I think, 11 stations in 3 years, I did a lot of stuff at Radio Sheffield, and a guy called Jeff Sargeston was the programme organiser at Sheffield, and he got the gig of being the programme controller at Radio Air when that opened in 81. We got on pretty well. I think we made sort of pub mates, you see. And he thought, do you want a job here? And, of course, the cool guys were in commercial radio back in the early 80s, you see. Oh, yeah. So that was, you know, I remember the guy, the late John Warwick, saying to me once, "You're joining the winning side." Went, "Yeah, sure am." Thought, "I'm going to be a cool DJ. I'm going to have a car with my name on the side." Knowing like that, I'm going to be just so cool. Each and every day, we're coming to you. And we tipped up at Radio Air. I did lunchtime for about the first 3 months, and then it looked like things weren't going very well. So therefore, they had a bit of a change round, and I ended up doing afternoons. And then, about 18 months in, things really weren't going very well, particularly when the first JICRA came in to show that apart from LBC, we had the smallest audience of any on the network. And at that point, you know, the advertising support collapsed because we couldn't show that we had anything to sell. And also, of course, being the sort of station it was, it had spent all its money on building purpose-built premises and hiring an enormous newsroom, etc., all to keep the IBA happy, which you had to do at that point. The Independent Broadcasting Authority, which was... They were the people who were in charge, and in fact, they were told you what you had to do, and they ruled with an iron fist. Because I remember Radio Air had got the franchise because they said, "We're not going to be a radio jukebox. We are going to be a meaningful speech station and play records as well," which is exactly what the IBA wanted. They wanted meaningful stuff. They didn't want stations which sounded like jukeboxes, even though going, "Those were the ones that people listened to." But that had nothing to do with it. So therefore, if you apply for a franchise, you make extravagant promises, which in the end, of course, you can't possibly fulfil because they're financially impossible to. And so we had an enormous newsroom. And so he said, "Well, of course, what we'll be doing our news on the hour, and what we'll have, we won't bother with IRN, we'll have our own news, we won't mix it." Right? So in fact, the day before, again, this is a startup problem, the day before, I think, we were due to go on air, the IBA turned around and said, "Excuse me, we want you to take IRN and then do your local news afterwards." We went, "Why? We already said we're going to do this." Went, "Well, if you go ahead and do that, we're going to pull the plug before you even start. So therefore, you know, 48, 24 hours before we were due on the air, the newsroom was in turmoil trying to rejig all the stuff they were going to do. So, you know, that didn't help very much.
Independent Radio News, it's 3 minutes past 12.
And the local news headlines, police...
I do remember day one. Graham Thornton says, "I'm going to be here with you every morning here on Radio Air." That was actually 3 months of every morning.
And this is Graham Thornton, and I'll be with you every weekday morning with The Breakfast Show.
And then shortly after that, he dropped a lot of carts on the desk and it went off the air. But Pilot of the Airways was the first record, Charlie Dore.
Pilot of the Airways, here is my request.
Because I know that they'd asked Charlie Dore to re-sing it. And she'd said, "Yes, of course, but it'll cost you something like £17,000, which back then, well, it still is a lot of money now, but it was an enormous amount of money back then.
and you seem like a friend to me.
Wouldn't she do it now for £17,000? I bet she would.
4 minutes past six on The Breakfast Show with Graham. That's Charlie Dore and Pilot of the Airwaves. It's Tuesday, the 1st of September, 1981.
All I do know is that apparently the managing director and the board members listened until the first ad break and they went, ah, good, and then switched off. So, you know, that's, as long as the money was coming in, fair enough. And that was that.
8 minutes past six.
When you're not sure just how to cope and things look bleak, not a hope, it's nice to know you're...
It's nice to know when you need help with money matters. The Huddersfield and Bradford Building Society is nice to know.
It was terribly exciting, but then the awful looming thought that actually this isn't going very well. It turned from being one of the most exciting times of my life to one of the most miserable, because the pressure was enormous, because you knew sooner or later you were probably going to get fired, but you didn't know how it would arrive. And so therefore you're thinking, oh, this isn't going too well. When I was, it wasn't exactly a total shock, but it was a big blow. By then, you know, they'd done all sorts of different things. They'd fiddled with this and fiddled with that. I remember the managing director saying publicly, you know, the amount of rebooking we're getting with advertisers is showing that it augurs well for a first dipstick or whatever. And when it came out, we showed we've got nobody listening at all. I said, how did that happen? He said, oh, I lied. You know, I just, you're not going to turn around and say, actually, no one's booking, because we obviously not do very well. And so I think, and like all these things, I think what happens is when something's not going very well, everybody blames everybody else. And as probably one of the most junior people there, I thought, they're probably going to blame me. And sure, I was gone within 18 months. Studio, there were Audix studios, and they were state-of-the-art for the time, because they'd spent all the money on the technology as well. And it was the first 8-track reel-to-reel I'd ever seen in the commercial production department, because really it was the first commercial production department I'd ever seen. I remember going in there very proudly to provide an advertising voiceover, which I knew was going to be on Beacon, because I think it was Ansell's Bitter, and I had to be the barman and go, "Two bitters, is it, lads?" And apparently they turned my voice down because it was too common. The accent was too thick, they thought, for it, so therefore I didn't get to go on Beacon after all, even on an advert. We had these wonderful new EMT decks. Turntables, which were tremendous. And one of their things which was so cool, which we'd never come across before, you would never be able to wow a record, because of course no sound would come out until it was running at the right speed, which is brilliant, until you try and line up a record, and you can't. So therefore I remember everyone just, you know, the dry runs for a couple of days beforehand, with just records starting ages before the sound or halfway through the intro and this sort of stuff, as the engineers were desperately trying to figure out how to switch this little wonderful modification off. But yes, and we didn't have to take level on anything, because there was a line across the desk where therefore you open the faders at that point and of course it'd be fine. The only problem is that was the dawn of the K-Tel and the Ronco records, which of course were so quiet that you know, you whacked them up to the line on the desk and you were still too low, and you put it up as high as you could and all you could hear was crackling. So that wasn't the best thing in the entire world.
It's Star Time by Ronco. 17 original hits with Cheap Trick.
You know, we had the triple stack cartridge players. I can't for the life of me remember what they were, but they also had that... wonderful thing, yeah, the technology is incredible. You know, it was like moon landing stuff, as far as I was concerned, where one advert fired the next one. And of course, no matter what was going on, you'd always hit one cartridge, you'd always be rattling away like mad, you know, particularly during the news, if, you know, the journalists would arrive with two or three cartridges, the bits on, you know, and you put them in no time to line them up, so you just hoped that they'd be the news journalists had actually bothered to line them up when they sort of listened to them when they'd carted them up in the newsroom, and one of them would make an incredible rattle, 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 rattle noise as he was reading the next cue. But Krista Aykroyd was one of the journalists there. She became news editor after I left. People who went on to bigger things, as James Whale did the evening, did night times. Martin Kellner was there. Eric Smith, who's been on Radio Shropshire Breakfast probably since about a day after he left Radio Air, so he's been there for getting on for 40 years, I think. Mark Easton, who is now a big cheese in BBC News and Current Affairs. You know, I see him on television all the time. Hasn't aged at all, which I find rather disturbing. He must have it in league with the devil. On one occasion, we had to go to, you know, there's all these PR things. We had to go out to go around the working men's clubs for personal appearances, etc. I think I still have my satin jacket with Radio Air in blue lettering on the back. And we went out, and he was Mark Easton was a new romantic. So this is Leeds in 1981. So he was wearing lipstick and had eyeshadow and nail varnish on, going to sort of working men's clubs in Guiseley. And we went to one, and I was there. I was supposedly to put the turn on. It was a cabaret singer who had a wonderful sparkly frock, but looked and sounded exactly like Lily Savage. And I knocked on the door. Again, I was pretty fairly timid in those days. I was about 23, 24. And this man, yes, opened the door. And I went, are you the drummer? She said, no, I'm there to put you on. All right. And they said, do you want to do the bingo? And I went, I don't know the calls. And Mark Easton says, I'll do it, I'll do it. And so this vision with eyeshadow and glittery nails sat there with as the balls came out of the cabinets. He knew them all, you know, two fat ladies, 88, and he got to 6 and 9, soixante neuf, he said. So we barely escaped with our lives on several occasions. But looking back on it, it was fascinating, and it was great fun to start off with. But when the shit hit the fans, it stopped being fun very quickly. So after Radio Air, I thought, what the hell am I going to do now? And again, my career has always been like this. I'm really very fortunate because Radio Derby, where I'd been sent prior to that years ago, what had happened? They'd lost their mid-morning show guy, so I turned up to do Line Up, which was their mid-morning show. That was Monday to Friday, and I did a Sunday programme there as well. And also on a Saturday, I did Centre Radio, which was the station in Leicester which had a dubious distinction of being the first one to go bust. And the thing was, they were paying me 30 quid a show. Now, that was in 1983. There's a lot of stations now that don't even pay that, so it just shows you how things have deteriorated over the years. But Derby, that was actually the making of me, because what had happened was I was completely destroyed by the experience at Air. I thought, you've been on the radio, you've been on a station which has been a catastrophic failure. What's more, you were part of that catastrophic failure, so obviously you are a failure as well. But going to Derby, and my producer was a friend of mine who I'd been at college with, a guy called Ashley Franklin. And you know, a lot of people know him. He's now a photographer, a very successful one too. And so therefore, we had the best fun. We had a marvellous time, and it was great. And I was there for about 5 months. And then, of course, I got the itch to be on commercial radio again. And at that point, there was a vacancy going at Radio Tees in Stockton-on-Tees. So, and also, I'd been let go by Centre Radio because they couldn't afford the 30 quid just before they tipped over into bankruptcy and then went off the air.
I regret to inform you that the company has now ceased trading. We are off the air, a further statement.
So off I went to Stockton-on-Tees. I can honestly say, of all the places I've worked, there's probably only about four or five people I've worked for who I've thought, these people are, there's some good people, but these people are really, really inspirational. They're amazing people. They really know how to treat people, and they know how to get the best out of people, and they've got vision, and they have tremendous ideas. And a guy called Donald Klein, who, he's not been in the industry for 30 years, but people still talk about him. What a great guy he was. Because he knew how to deal with people, and he could see the big picture. And he knew, Stockton-on-Tees, we were number one in the marketplace by a long way. You know, this was 1983, and everyone was dressed in 70s clothing because they couldn't. All their 80s stuff had worn out, and they couldn't afford to buy new stuff. So you never seen them in any pair of flare trousers. The high street in Stockton, the local council used to put the unemployment figures on a building in the middle of the high street. The place was on its uppers back then. Everything had shut. It was terrible. But the station was great.
Julian Lennon and Too Late for Goodbyes. 9 1/4 minutes after 10 o'clock on the Sound of Home. A very good morning to you, the last one of the week. Also, Michael Bentley.
And it was such fun. Never worked so hard in my life. Well, in fact, I started off doing the lunchtime show, then Paul Robinson, who's now a big cheese in the industry, he left to go to Mercia in Coventry. So I took over mid-mornings and also did Sundays. So there's Sunday show. During the summer, or was it the winter, I think, it became Trains and Boats and Planes, which was the holiday programme, which meant that, it was a good way of making money, because it was a good way, all the advertisers were travel agents, etc. And it was my job to organise this, because I was not only presenting stuff, but I was also producing stuff as well, and having to do all of it. You go in the newsroom and say, I've got a villa for sleeps four, in the Algar for a fortnight in August. Anybody fancy that? And people go, oh, great family holiday. Just do us 20 minutes, would you? And so therefore, that's what would happen. It would be these people's holidays. And so you go, OK then, the bloke Jules Bellaby. Actually, he was known as Oscar that back then, because Donald actually insisted on people changing their names. You know, it was the dawn of the bizarre DJ name. And he said to me, how do you fancy being called Red? Now, Red Lester. But everyone's going, Red Lester, yeah, as in the cheese. And I'm going, Red Lester, Red, this isn't going to work. So I was just actually saved, because there's a guy called Tony Harrison, became Harry Harrison. Jules Bellaby became Oscar Bellaby. And so I was Alex Lester still, which, though I did actually have to go out and give a load of cheese out in car parks in Peter Lee in the freezing cold weather. And then you go, right, I've got a week at Butlins in Skegness. So I went to Butlins to see, you know, I was a pretty, you know, where was the glamour in this? I went to Butlins, I went to Skegness, I went to Butlins and Skegness, I went to Eastbourne, then I also, but I did get to go to Iceland, that's and San Francisco.
Actually, on a final note about cable cars for the time being, before we get to the cable car barn, is a directory of local San Francisco.
Because Donald Klein, who was in charge, said, go to San Francisco and meet up with my mate Don Blue. He's the breakfast host on KYUU, Hit Music Free Money. So therefore, the summer of September 85, thinking, this is so cool, first trip to America, I'd like to get to San Francisco, turn up there, turn the radio on, wow.
KYUU, mystery voice.
This is 99.7 KYUU.
All right. Anita Patterson of San Francisco on the line with us. Hello, Anita.
Hi.
You pretty excited?
Yeah.
Fantastic. KYUU, Hit Music Free Money, is long gone. But it was a brilliant station because they were all personalities. It was tight and the music was just what would you expect from West Coast in 1985. And whilst I was there, people regard it as a guilty pleasure and a cheesy record now, but Starship, We Built This City came out.
We built this city.
It actually came out while I was there.
We built this city on rock and roll. We built this city.
And the B-side was taken to all stations in the same demographic in the Bay Area, and they said, you know the gap in the middle which has the radio announcer? Put your own stuff in. Tune around the dial, you go, oh, this is just so fantastic. And I had a marvelous time.
Looking out over that Golden Gate Bridge on another gorgeous sunny Saturday, and I'm seeing that bumper-to-bumper traffic.
Then you come back to Stockton-on-Tees. So Stockton-on-Tees lasted until about 86, and then I went back to the BBC, to BBC Essex, which was opening, and they hadn't got a breakfast show presenter. So I thought, oh, right, fair enough. I went down there and got the job. You know, Radio Air took a month to set up. BBC Essex took 6 months. So by the time we're tearing our hair out by the time we actually got on the air on the 5th of November, because we'd be there all summer. Every evening we seemed to be sort of having things on sticks and wine with local dignitaries and things like that. And it was the time where I think Margaret Thatcher, who was 86, had got her, put the, I think it was the death on the rock business, and so therefore we think we lost a director general at that point.
Sunday morning on the Costa del Sol, and among the holidaymakers, three Irish terrorists were planning a bloodbath.
And the BBC, as it always does, was panicking, so it didn't know what to do. So therefore, what you'd have, you go, well, the station's going to be this, and about a week later you go, well, actually, it's going to be that. And they go, well, no, it could be this. And you, in the end, you go, make your bloody mind up, because I've got no idea what you're talking about. And I was in the newsroom, and I asked the news editor and the programme organiser these closed questions. And in unison, they said, yes, no. I went, in that case, I've got no idea what's going on. So that wasn't a happy experience.
A very good morning and welcome to your brand new radio station, countywide BBC Essex. I'm Alex Lester, and I'll be with you each weekday morning for The Breakfast Show. In the first hour today, as well as the best travel and your favourite music...
Well, it was a mixture of news and music. It was a lot of featurey type news packages. So you had a lot of that going on. And also, being Essex, it had a lot of travel, which we'd never really bothered with up to that point, because also we're very proud of this, we're going to have travel, we're going to get people to phone up using their mobile phones and go, wow, because of course I'd come down from Stockton. They hadn't got mobile phones in Stockton, but they were just getting them around the M25. You see, thinking, oh, this is novel. Admittedly, my view that I wanted to do what Don Blue was doing on KYUU, which is having a gopher, which is a bloke in a silly with a silly voice doing their travel, which struck me as being a lot more than it. But no, they were a bit po-faced about that. They didn't, but again, it was these ones where you're sitting there, even though it was 1986, when you heard the management talk about TC1 or TC2, which stood for Travel Crumpet 1 or Travel Crumpet 2. We were auditioning women to be the travel presenters. And even then I was thinking, ooh, sorry, I'm not really on board with this one. But we did play music, but again, they were terrified of music. I wasn't allowed to play Fontella Bass Rescue Me, said the programme organiser. I said, why? Because it's our demographic. You know, it's a classic record. The manager doesn't like it. And I said, well, what do you think? He said, I don't know, I've never heard it. He goes, right, OK, so we've got the two people in charge who don't know anything about music at all, telling me that things to play. And at one point we did actually have a massive falling out when we went to the library, and I said, right, let's go through the playlist, because we had a playlist as well, a playlist, and you tell me the records I can play from the playlist and the records I can't, and why not? And there was a Whitesnake track, which I think is Whitesnake. It would have been their power ballad thing, so it wasn't going to frighten any horses. And it said, what's the matter with that? Oh, you can play that after 7 o'clock. Why not before? Just because. Well, because that's not... I asked you for reasoning. Gut reaction. And he said, look, it's like this. If my 10-year-old daughter can hum it, you can play it. And I went... What's our demographic? Well, it's 35 to 55. Well, that makes her 25 years too young for the bloody demographic, doesn't it? And it, you know, it was not good. Is this love that I'm feeling? And luckily I got rescued by Radio 2 at that point, because there was an attachment advertised for a trainee announcer. The idea was to go for 6 months, and at the end of the 6 months, that would be it. There wasn't a job. So, right, okay. So off I went, and... did all those things that announcers do at Radio 2 at that particular point. This was 87. Read the news, rather badly. Did continuity in the evening, rather badly. And then poor old Ray Moore upped and died. And that was the first time I did a radio show. I did Night Ride, the late night show for late night people, because Steve Madden, who'd been doing it, had been taken off to cover for Ray, who, you know, obviously they just said, oh, he's off, but didn't explain why until later. So I actually did my first ever Radio 2 show. And I thought, this is it, the pinnacle of my career. I can die a happy man. I've actually done a show on a national radio station.
The late night show for late night people, Night Ride. Radio 2, Alex Lester.
Terrifying. But I don't know why it should have been, because I remember someone asking me the other day, is it any different? In the end, it isn't really. You think in a slightly different way. If I'm going to be talking about Scotland all the time, it's not really necessarily relevant to the audience. There's that. You're aware that you are putting in more references to different things. But other than that, no. To start off with, there was the staffing thing, which was quite exciting. And also, when I went to Radio 2 in 1987, the equipment was the Type D Continuity, which is wonderful pieces of furniture with quadrant faders, nerd fans. I remember one of the early editions of Night Ride I did, because, of course, needle time restrictions. You also had a selection of tapes, music tapes, but you also had a tape operator as well. So therefore, there would be three of you. Because the producer would be at home, usually drunk. So therefore, and you, really, one occasion, I remember the light flashing, and so I picked up the extension of this voice, and, oh, God, like... And that was interesting, because all these people at that period had worked with all the greats. You know, they'd been there. These people who were in their 40s and 50s, when I were 20 years older than me, had been there when The Dying Embers, The Home, The Light and The Third, and they'd been there at the start of Radio 1, and then all that. And also, they'd been working with Wogan and John Dunn. All this stuff. So therefore, this bloke turns up they'd never seen before. We were the only nighttime service at that point, and the Radio 1 wasn't 24 hours. And you had the people who were running the other networks would have some downtime at that point, so they'd come over and socialise. And I can remember looking through the glass thinking, wow, am I really doing well here? And seeing, I counted them, there were 13 people with their backs to me, all drinking cans of beer. And I thought, they don't give a flying fuck about me, do they really? But still, fair enough. And on another occasion, I can still remember going in, and I went, hello there, and they just ignored me. And I went in and played a few carts and spun a couple of, I think we had CDs by then, but also vinyl as well. And thought, well, there's nothing, I've done some level and stuff like that. So the show started, off we went, and I looked up, in the flickering glow of MTV, she was knitting. And never said a word to me the whole time I was there, you know. But they'd seen it all. So who was I? I was just someone who came in from outside. You know, we've seen them all. He'll be gone soon. But I hung on for 30 years. So, you know, there we go.
Alex Lester.
All the announcers were fabulous. You know, again, they'd been there for a long time. And so the wonderful people like James Alexander Gordon, who was a fund of wonderful stories.
If Arsenal have lost, I'm sorry for them. If Manchester United have won, I'm happy for them.
And David Bellon, who I still see from time to time, he's excellent. And he'd been on the Today programme with Jack DeManio. This is the sort of thing, these are the people you know, people like John Dunn, you know, people I'd grown up with. Everybody on BBC local radio had in their mind that they wanted to be like John Dunn. But John Dunn was unique, because he was a technical guy himself. If he was introducing something, which was on tape maybe, he would still fade up a guest microphone so the atmosphere was right in the studio, because he knew all that sort of stuff. And also, he was terribly, terribly nice.
Well, let me tell you what lies ahead. After 7, Watergate journalist Bob Woodward...
And I did a variety of things as well, which is great, because as an announcer, you did all sorts of stuff. And I did lots and lots of those announcing shifts at the now long-disappeared Paris Studios in Lower Regent Street, where you had the comedy programmes, which, if they were ever trying to make the trailers for the comedy programmes, they would spool against the heads on the reel-to-reel of the tape to find the biggest laugh. And I actually even took part in a few of those as well, including a doomed pilot for a comedy western called Giddy Up, which never saw the light of day, mainly because I was in it, and it also didn't have any jokes in it, which was a bit of a shame, really, but still, never mind, I enjoyed that. But I did do 6 episodes, I think, of One Foot in the Grave. To me, it worked better as a radio show than it did on television, because the words really came across, and that was fun, and also the people were great to work with. I was working with all these people, you know, people who'd been on things like the Navy Lark, John Pertwee and people like that. People who'd worked with the Goons. You know, I'm there at Paris Studios behind the curtain, and there's, you know, there's this great big wardrobe with all the knockers and knobs and latches and things like that, which must have been used on everything, going right back to Much Binding in the Marsh and before then, you know, and it was absolutely tremendous. But over the years, all that sort of stuff evaporated because they didn't want to do it any longer. People died, and also... No, the finance had gone for it, really. So the Paris studio shut in about 1994, 1995. Golders Green Hippodrome went probably a similar sort of period and things like that. So, and also the fact is that the station changed, because it had a very bizarre music policy when I was there. They would actually, you know, they would be playing novelty records all over the place. And thinking, why? There was a phrase that used to go around, well, don't forget the lollipops. And I have never, I've been in broadcasting now for 40 years, and no one has ever explained to me what lollipops supposedly are. There's something to do with me, don't forget your lollipops, going, what the hell are lollipops? I've got no idea what lollipops are. You know, they would go, ah, yes, Tom Jones, Engelbert Humperdinck. Tom Jones, what's new, Pussycat? Engelbert Humperdinck, please release me. Tom Jones has done a version of Please Release Me, and let's do that, let's swap them over. But you'd end up, not the version you knew and loved being played, but another version by a different artist. You go, why? And I can still remember Rose Marie's version of These Boots Are Made For Walking, which was absolutely terrifying. I used to actually shudder whenever I played it and I'd turn the speakers down, because this woman absolutely terrified the life out of me.
I thought that was diabolical.
Then they realised, and that was the sort of Francis Lyon era, that they were losing 200,000 of the audience every year due to Radio Grim Reaper, and therefore they're going to have to lower the age range, or there would be nobody left. And that's when Jim Moyer took over, and that, to me, was the best period, because he had a softly, softly catchy monkey version, because, of course, we'd seen what had happened at Radio 1, where they'd managed to throw the baby out with the bathwater, and they just axed everything within seconds. Because the BBC, as you know only too well, tends to work on politics and whim rather than actual strategy, and so, therefore, politics was very much involved, I think, in that Radio 1 thing of going, we need to make a change, we need to make it now. But Jim was a wiser counsellor than that, going, right, OK, we've seen that that's not a really good idea, let us now evolve. And that's what he did. If you were the guy in the middle of the night, which we were, you weren't regarded as a presenter. You were regarded as an announcer filling with music until the network started again. Jim took over and went, "You do realise that anybody who's on the radio to the person at home is a star." So therefore, they used to have the Radio 2 presenters' lunch, which we were never invited to. Then, when Jim took over, it was the Radio 2 presenters' party, and we were all invited. The difference between a network and a radio station is the network has no soul to it. I've been on the same radio station as the people like Hubert Gregg. Never met him in my life. He's long dead now. I thought he was a genius at what he did. He's the bloke that wrote "Maybe It's Because I'm a Londoner." And he had a wonderful way with words. Never met him. On a radio station where there's like 20 people or whatever, you're all in it together. You know, you all go down the pub together. That's fine. There's a sense of community. There wasn't and there isn't. Jim made it far more that. It was good for me because he was the person who went, actually, I think Alex has got a bit of talent here. So therefore, I did get to be Wogan's regular debt for 12 months. I did. Steve Wright used to call me standing in guy because I did absolutely everything. The only show I didn't do of all the daytime shows was Jimmy Young. But I nearly did, but he was late. I was about poised to do it, but I didn't. So to me, that was the best time of my career. And you've got to understand it, colleagues of mine go, why don't they have proper presenters on Radio 2? You go, because it's Radio 2, that's why. It's a different beast. And you can't say it's not successful, because it is. But the rationale is, are you famous? Yes. Right, OK, we'll think about talking to you, about maybe putting you on the station. So therefore, I'm very fortunate it's actually lasted 30 years, really, because I never got to be famous. If my television career, which was actually presenting, co-presenting The Boat Show on BBC Two, one episode of Eggheads and two episodes of Call My Bluff, wasn't going to trouble Jonathan Ross as Mr. Saturday Night. If I had had a television career, that may have been a different scenario altogether. I don't know. I was actually up overnights for 26 years out of the 30 years I was there, really, Monday to Friday. Very loyal audience, and, you know, some of them were with me all the way. Because a lot of people, like me, spent 30 years working nights. And this is the thing, and this is the thing that does gall me. Overnights were never... There was an American guy who once said, you can always tell you're the overnight guy if you wander into the station during the day when the managing director says, can I help you? Because... it's always been the way, and I don't think it'll ever change. Yes, the audience isn't as big, but if you're on a station as big as Radio 2, again, I'm going to blow smoke up my own arse here because it's important to me. And I, you know, again, I can look back at my career and go, yes, I never got to be Mr. Saturday Night, but I got to present some of the biggest shows on the biggest station in the country. And also I had my own show with an audience of, when it was 3 until 6, it was 1 million people. When it went back 2 till 5, because again, it always was that thing of, you had to get used to it, really. You go, right, okay, it's galling, it's frustrating. They're bringing in people from outside who I don't think are very good, but they're on the television. Unless you were famous, because they had Bungalow Bill Wiggins on doing Gloria Hunniford's show, because he was going out with Joan Collins. That was good enough. You know, John Stalker, well, he was Deputy Chief of Manchester Police. That was the rationale. So therefore, it didn't matter how good you were in many ways. Because let's face it, I've been very fortunate. There's probably far, far better people than me out there who never got the chances that I got. And those who think are going, how come bloody Alex Lester spent 30 years on Radio 2? He's shit. You know, we were far better than him. We never got, you know, sent the tapes in, never got anywhere. No, I got in by a back route as an announcer. That's how I managed it and somehow managed to cling on. It was always frustrating at times, but then again, you just have to sort of rise above it, going... you're on the biggest station in Europe, OK? They're paying you pretty handsomely, but nothing like you'd expect. But it was still pretty good. You've got your own show, and they leave you to your own devices, and we're having fun here, and we're developing something which you won't get anywhere else. The biggest blow was not being moved from 3 until 6 to 2 until 5. It was actually when they decided, we don't care about them to the extent, we don't care about the audience to the extent that we'll put some repeats on. So I knew... 2 years ago, I was next for the bullet because there was nowhere for me to go. And I knew the 2 till 5 show had 200,000 more listeners than any other radio station in the country and anything the BBC was doing overnight. And they axed it. to put some repeats out. And then I only got the three nights out of the seven. So what does that tell you? It tells you that the writing is on the wall, so you better think of, go elsewhere. Also, they said, you got three nights a week. We want a totally generic and bland show to run seven nights a week. Well, that's not what I do, and certainly not what Janice Long does either. So they imposed a format, which wasn't a very good format. You know, it was not a very pleasant 2 years. But then again, excuse me, I was still on the biggest station in Europe. So, and there was nothing else around which had been offered or I wanted to do, really. So there you go. You win some, you lose some. I can't look back on my career and go, what a waste of time that was. I had a magnificent time.
We often used to say, yip to Hootie, the gateway to the weekend as well, I seem to remember back in the day. Ramping up the camp, Gloria Gaynor, Never Can Say Goodbye. Thank you. I've had a wonderful 30 years. We created something unique. The time has flown. I shall miss you. Thank you.
The BBC is a wonderful organisation. I'll say that without a doubt. The business and the bile, it's reserved for Radio 2 because it seemed to me 2 years ago, it was obvious they didn't care about the licence fee payers who listened in the middle of the night. They didn't care about them. So that was galling. It would have been better in some ways if they turned around and said, Alex, we don't want you to do it any longer. Go. We'll get someone else in and it'll be live broadcasting at night. We think we need to freshen it up a bit. Rather than going, we care so little about the people at night. In fact, one guy from commercial, a senior commercial radio bloke said to me once, when the shit hit the fan about the 5 days a week, he said, this looks to us in commercial radio like a political act, and I think, you know, because it doesn't cost that much. Radio 2 now has lost a lot of its budget, still has a budget of £50 million. I'd love to know what that's being spent on, because in the end people go, oh, you know, what about you and your team? There was me and my and producer Simon, who was great. You know, that was the team. They've let the audience down. From a personal point of view, it says something about the people who are running somewhere like Radio 2, for instance. If anybody who does a job anywhere, and it could be any job, whether you are the person who is digging ditches, someone who is a nurse, someone who's a lorry driver, whatever, after 30 years working for one organisation, you would have thought somebody would say, thanks very much indeed. We've appreciated your contribution. That didn't happen to me after 30 years. In a conversation which lasted less than, I was in and out of the building under 10 minutes. You're going, you know what? Someone could at least say thank you. And they didn't. All we got was a rather bland statement which said about the axing of the After Midnight show, which we've been doing for 2 years. We thank Janice and Alex for their contribution to the programme. That was the only thanks you got. So that's left a bit of a bitter taste in the mouth. Bearing in mind the BBC is supposed to be better than the other organisations. It sets itself up to be a beacon of how it deals with people and its diversity and all this sort of stuff and how it deals with its staff. That is not a good way when two people on eye-watering salaries get rid of you in under 10 minutes without actually saying thank you for 30 years of service. That's the thing that does stick in my craw, I must admit. But really, genuinely, it's the audience I feel sorry for because they enjoyed it. The audience deserve live programming because they pay the licence fees. They deserve it.
It's okay, you can weep now. Jimmy Ruffin, Farewell as a Lonely Sound. So from me, Alex Lester, from me to you. I hope you'll find me somewhere.
Life Beyond. Well, I knew that something was going to happen 2 years ago, so therefore, you know, I was very delighted when Oxford, Radio Oxford, said, would you like to do our Friday afternoon? I thought, why not? And that's been a great fun. Then Radio Kent said, how'd you like to do 4 hours of playing tunes? I thought, well, that's a good idea. And then I got to do 3 weeks at Radio WM, which, of course, was Radio Birmingham, the heart of the nation station where I started out 40 years ago. And I had a great time doing it. Because, again, it was all speech, but it was not all turgid speech about dog poo and council elections, etc. There was an element of that, because, of course, that's an element of what it does. That is news for the population of the West Midlands. But there was fooling about, even better. So, therefore, you know, you can do fooling about talk as well as serious talk, and now they're going to say, well, you can do an hour of tunes as well. So I'll be doing 6 until 9, an hour of tunes between 6 and 7, and then 2 hours of fooling about and news and sport. What's not to like about that? Right back where I started from.
Let's have a look, see. What's the time now? It's 18 minutes past 7, and I'm joined once again. Oh, yes. Excellent. I'm joined once again by Chris Clark. Morning, Chris.
Morning.
Yeah.
I've had the best time. What's not to like? I've been on the radio for 40 years. The radio itself is fabulous. It's the stuff that goes with it that isn't. And that comes and goes. Wherever you go, if you go to a radio station, they hire you. you obviously like them. But at some point there is what we describe as editorial bruising, where somebody else gets fired, maybe. And it's nothing to do with you. It's just that the management decide they want to change, which is, you know, what they do, their management. So therefore, the person who's on this way out hates the person who just hired you, who you really like. So therefore, you're never going to consensus anyway. But the actual job itself, what's not to like? You know, it's marvellous. And also the fact is, it's great for me, because I've been doing sort of one sort of thing for the last sort of 20, 30 years. Now I'm doing something different again. So you figure, why at my age, you know, there's more stuff to learn. But then I can bring things to the party and people can teach me things as well. Again, you know, the world changes, the industry changes. Because when I started at Radio 2 back in 1987, it was very much a 60-plus audience. So therefore, you were talking about people who were born in the 20s, if not the turn of the century. And there was me at 30 trying to broadcast to my grandparents, if you like. And that's got all parents and grandparents. That's more difficult. And then, by the time I left, I was broadcasting to myself, if you like, my same people, my contemporaries. Now going to WM, it's a slightly different skew. I can't really complain. You know, when you look back at it and go, you had 30 years on the biggest station in the country, you did Radio 4, little bits of telly, you worked in commercial radio, you worked on lots of different shows, you were an announcer, you did comedy shows, you worked with Richard Wilson, for goodness sake, you introduced concerts, you stood in front of an orchestra, you did all this sort of stuff. How brilliant is that? You did holiday programmes, you know, that's tremendous. And you played records and asked about on the radio. That's, and you invented stuff as well. That's terrific. And you worked with some amazingly creative people. That's terrific as well.